Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix with Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on the show this morning, the battle over the Affordable Care Act is not over, at least not yet, and there are activists rallying for it in Arizona today. We'll check in with them and we'll talk about the Rough Riders and get a little bit of Arizona history.
But first, Pima County is looking into leasing part of a juvenile detention facility to a local aid group in order to house asylum seekers. Catholic Community Services has been using Tucson's Benedictine Monastery, but it has to be out by the end of the month. So the group is asking Pima County to lease it the building near Kino Sports Complex. With us to talk more about this is Pima County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry. Chuck, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm well. So what is it about this particular facility that seems like it would be a good fit for the purpose here?
Well, it's a facility that is significantly underutilized by the county at this time. It was built to house as many as 350 juveniles. Today we have ranging from 30 to 50 in it, so it's about one-tenth of its utilization. There are three units that can house as many as, we'll say, 200 to 300 asylum seekers. That is basically unused today, and it can be converted into a dormitory-type setting, which is conducive to this transition for asylum seekers from release of custody from ICE and the Border Patrol to then the transfer to their sponsors in the United States.
How much work would have to be done to get the facility as it is now to what Catholic Community Services and the other groups working with them would like it or need it to be for this other purpose?
Fairly little. A couple of doors need to be added to the facility to make it flow better for their processes, shade structures, and we need to add a little bit of, we'll say, art and other furniture that makes it appear more as a dormitory as opposed to a detention center. It has all the necessary support systems, which is the toilets and the showers and the dorm rooms for sleeping. And it also has access to a commercial kitchen that supports the facility, as well as a commercial laundry that's necessary to assist our faith-based nonprofit in basically operating the facility, and that's Catholic Community Services.
Why has Pima County been so involved in finding places? The letter from leaders at Catholic Community Services point out that you and your and Pima County were helpful in working with the Benedictine Monastery. You're working to find a space here. And I ask because it really seems to be in contrast to what's going on here with Maricopa County and the city of Phoenix, which really have not been doing this kind of work.
Well, I think the big issue is one of public safety. We believe it's much better to have these individuals processed safely through the community rather than to simply have ICE or the Border Patrol release them to the streets where they really have no idea of, what's ahead of them. They can become involved in activity that jeopardizes public safety. So I think we believe it's more appropriate to ensure that they have a safe and efficient center for processing these individuals to their final destinations as opposed to simply releasing them on the streets to fend for themselves.
Have you had communication with officials in other Arizona counties about what it is that you're doing and how you're doing it to see if it might work in other places?
We're part of a four-border county coalition with Yuma and Cochise and Santa Cruz. And we talk regularly about our border issues and basically how to accommodate what's occurring on the border so that it has no impact on our existing residents. And we're sharing this information with them. And again, I think we believe it's better to be in control of the situation rather than simply to let it evolve in an unplanned manner that typically can lead to problems within the community.
And quickly, Chuck, before we let you go, what still has to happen for this to become official?
couple of things. One is that we need to have a lease, and that lease is a nominal lease to a nonprofit entity that we're allowed to do for those facilities at Juvenile. It'll be before our Board of Supervisors on August the 6th, and it requires their approval. In addition to that, we're, you know, obviously making appropriate arrangements and accommodations and cleaning up the facility, making sure that all the utilities are working and in good order, and that's really about it. In addition to that, we'll be applying for humanitarian aid. There's a component of the federal funding called Operation Stone Garden that makes humanitarian aid possible to offset any of our cost in operating the facility, such as the utilities or the routine maintenance or the janitorial that's needed to clean the facilities. That will all be reimbursed by the federal government and is not be a burden on local taxpayers.
All right. That is Pima County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry. Chuck, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the call.
New research has found that crime in L.A. goes up on days when the high temperature is above 85 degrees. The link between rising mercury and rising crime rates has been known for some time, but this new study finds the relationship is stronger in low-income neighborhoods. Killian Heilman is a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Southern California's Institute for New Economic Thinking. He worked on the study and joins me to talk more about it. And Killian, it seems as though you're able to put an actual temperature on when crime may start to rise. Is that right?
That's true. We're looking at the city of Los Angeles, and we find the biggest effect around temperatures between 85 and 105 degrees Fahrenheit.
What is it about that range, do you think, that does it?
We're not entirely sure. One idea is that Los Angeles is a very temperate city. The average maximum daily temperature is around 76. So between 85 and 105, that is hot for LA, but it's not extremely hot. And we think that people still go about their daily life and go to work. But during that temperature range, they become more aggressive and commit more crimes. But it's not that so hot that the city would shut down, that people don't go out anymore and don't commit any crimes anymore. We think it's a hot day, but it's not extremely hot.
So do you think it's safe to say then that for these results to maybe correlate to other cities, it would have to be a temperature that is warmer than average, warmer than people are used to, but not so hot that people are just sort of cloistered inside in the air conditioning?
That's correct. So we haven't really looked at many other cities yet, but it's probably the case that hotter cities are more adapted to high heat, so they wouldn't react as strongly as Los Angeles did at that temperature.
Does it matter the percentage of people who maybe have air conditioning at home or have access to some kind of cooling system somewhere?
Most certainly. So we find that the effect of heat on crime is much stronger in neighborhoods which have old housing. So in Los Angeles, not all houses do have air conditioning, and that is correlated with the age of the housing stock. So older housing wasn't built with air conditioning, and it's still the case that older housing is less likely to have air conditioning even today, and the effect is much stronger in these older neighborhoods. So we do think that air conditioning is one adaptation strategy to deal with high heat and to dampen the effect on crime.
So what exactly is the relationship between higher temperatures and crime? Like, why do people commit more crime seemingly when it gets hotter out?
Mm-hmm. So that is also not exactly clear. There are in general two mechanisms. One is a physiological mechanism. That is that our bodies just don't work as well during high temperatures. So we become less patient, become more aggressive, and then commit more crimes. But then there's also an economic theory in the sense that criminals make rational decisions. So you can think about the fact that, or you can think about that on hotter days, you need more money to fight heat, and then you commit more crimes. Right? So that's an economic story. We don't really think that the economic story makes much sense. So we really think that it's a physiological story where people become more aggressive during high heat because our bodies are just not adapted to that kind of heat.
But you also did find that these numbers are maybe starker in lower-income neighborhoods, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. So we do think this is also a part of the adaptation story, that poorer people are just not well-adapted to higher temperatures because they probably can't afford solutions such as air conditioning or insulation, or they can't just not go to work. So poor people are more exposed to heat shocks.
Are there particular types of crimes that are more prevalent when it gets hotter out, or is this sort of across the board?
Absolutely. So we find the strongest effects for violent crime. So think about assault or rape. And we also find strong effects for crimes which are committed against people, the perpetrator knew, for example, domestic violence against family members. We don't really see an effect for property crimes. So it's not the case that people commit more thefts on hot days. It's really working through the violent crime.
Do you get the sense that law enforcement pays attention to this? Like, do they follow weather forecasts, or are they, do they try to maybe be more proactive or maybe have more of a presence in a city like LA, a more temperate city, when they know it's going to be warmer than average?
Some police departments certainly do take that into account, but it is very difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. So we are thinking about a statistical relationship which works on average. So it's not a very clear-cut relationship. We're thinking about long-term averages. But the police certainly does react to extreme heat. We actually find that during extreme heat, certain kinds of policing effort measures go down. It is much less likely to be pulled over for a traffic violation on a hot day. And we even see that investigations go down on hot days.
Why is that?
We think that the police equally reacts to high heat. If it's very hot outside, it becomes more costly to investigate crimes, and maybe police officers react to that cost and just step down a little bit.
That's Killian Heilman. He's a postdoctoral scholar at USC. Killian, good to talk to you. Thank you.
It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Maricopa County has the fastest growing Hispanic population of any county in the U.S. That's according to the latest figures from the U.S. Census. 2018 population estimates show the number of Latinos living in Maricopa County grew by 34,000 people since 2017. Overall, the Hispanic population grew the fastest in the southern U.S. over the past 10 years, adding 5.6 million Latinos. The slowest growth is in the west, where the population grew by 3.8 million. The Census Bureau estimates the overall Latino population at 59.9 million, or 18% of the U.S. population. And here to talk about what all of these new numbers mean is Lisa Urias, managing partner of Connex North America, a local strategic marketing, public relations, and public affairs firm. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Lauren.
So I know you say that this report points to the, quote, Latino wave having arrived. How do you make that?
Well, you know, we've been talking about the Latino wave of influence, the Latino wave of voters, but really this report is showing us that they have really arrived. I mean, 30 years old is a very prime formation time when young people are moving into their careers, they've graduated from college, their buying patterns are stronger, and they become more engaged voters.
But these numbers also show that the Hispanic population growth nationwide has slowed at the same time since the 2000s, and it slowed the most here in the West. I wonder if you can give us a sense of how different this is in terms of where these populations are settling and showing up than maybe a decade ago.
Sure. Well, the growth in the southern markets is really a higher percentage because they're much smaller markets altogether. Hmm. So the growth within the western states is still, we're still in the top 10 DMA demographic makeup of Latinos. So California, Arizona, Texas are very large population of Hispanics to begin with. So they're already established with large numbers of Latinos within those markets in Chicago, New York, Florida as well. So the growth within the southern states is just really reflective of smaller populations, but increasing demographics of Latinos.
Sure, sure. And there's always this idea that Latinos are the youngest racial or ethnic group in the U.S., and that's still true. But it also says in this report that it is growing, it is getting older, which makes sense. Does this how does that sort of settle with it, with this new wave of immigrants that are coming in now? I mean, is this going to continue to shift?
Well, you know, we have seen increasing migration from Central America, but the issue with the Latino voters that are in the U.S. now are really, these are U.S. citizens, they're permanent legal residents, there are people who have been here for a very long time now. So the news now really is that at this age of 30, we've seen a greater number of Latinos within our universities. Both University of Arizona and Arizona State University, for example, are Hispanic-serving institutions. They're becoming increasingly engaged in the marketplace, buying homes, buying cars, but also increasingly engaged in voting. In 2018, Hispanic voter turnout across the country was driven by those younger voters, 18 to 34, which is kind of unusual in the typical voting pattern.
Yeah. So, okay. So you bring up politics. So we'll end on that note. So I have to ask the question then, what does this mean if this Latino wave has arrived, especially here in Arizona, as we look toward 2020?
Well, what it means is that people need to pay attention to that voter, right? We need to pay attention to the issues that are of concern to them. Principally, I would suggest education. When you're 30, your kids are going to public education schools. They want to see strong public education. Their debt, if their student debt might be an issue from college. They're also very concerned about healthcare. Most of their parents were not necessarily very wealthy or deep-pocketed parents. And so they need to make sure that they have the kind of care that they need as they age. So they're going to be paying close attention and making a significant impact in the coming elections.
So you're also saying then that these are not exactly just, you know, just quote unquote Latino issues or something like that. This is people caring about all of those other issues that we talk about in politics.
There's no question. And that maturity helps a lot. So it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah. All right. That's Lisa Urias, managing partner of Konex North America. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Lauren.
Over the last few months, the need for foster families in our state has become desperate, according to one of the larger foster home licensing agencies in the country. Child Crisis Arizona reported last month there were only 2 open beds in the nearly 200 homes currently licensed with the agency. And even though the number of children in the system has gone down in recent years, there are still 13,000 children in foster care in our state. So what does it take to become a foster parent, and why do people decide to do it? To shed some light on those questions, I sat down with Leah Phillips. She and her husband became foster parents 2 years ago, and now they are adoptive parents to a 9-year-old boy they began fostering in 2018. She says she's always wanted to be a foster parent since she watched foster kids on TV shows like Maury when she was a kid. But it didn't take her long to realize the process to become one is not easy, logistically and emotionally.
So first of all, to become a foster parent, you have to be able to pass background checks. There's a home inspection. There is required training, and that includes parenting classes, classes that teach you about trauma with children and how to address that as a parent, classes that teach you how to work with your child's biological family, because that's what foster care is all about. The first goal of foster care is to reunite the children with their biological family members. And so that's something that's covered in training. Of course, there's also CPR, first aid certification, things like that. And then as part of the home study, you work with a licensing worker that interviews you, your spouse, anyone else who's living in the home to try to get a sense of the home, make sure it's a safe place for children, but also to identify the types of children that you would be best able to foster parent. Because children coming into foster care are infants, there are teenagers, boys, girls. So that was part of the process too, was just identifying what child my husband and I would be best able to parent. And it did take quite a while to make it through all of those steps.
So now you are adoptive parents to a young boy who we're going to call Batman on air. And that's not his name. We're calling him Batman for reasons we will get to in a minute. But he wasn't the first foster child you had in your home, right? You had 2 others before. Can you tell us about what happened there and why those didn't work out?
So we were matched with 2 children prior to Batman, who we now adopted. Oddly, the first child we were matched with never actually moved into our home. He had been with a great aunt, and the great aunt was able to identify another family member who might be able to take the child, and so we stepped back.
Yeah.
The second child that was in our home was with us just very, very briefly. He had been placed in a shelter, and they were looking for a family that would be willing to transition him from shelter to their home as a foster placement. Mm-hmm. We essentially had him for about a long weekend. And unfortunately, he had a number of mental health issues, and it became unsafe for us to keep him in our home. Mm. He was trying to harm himself and was running away and would run away at night. And so he went to a shelter that was better able to care for him and ultimately got medical care at Phoenix Children's. We stayed in touch with him for as long as we could during this process, and I understand he was able to be reunited with an extended family member out of state. Mm-hmm. But it was very difficult. It was devastating.
So, I mean, when you're signing up to be a foster parent, like, that has to be one of your worst fears, because you know these kids are going to be coming from difficult circumstances and maybe facing issues like mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. I will admit it was very hard. We really wanted to do the best for him. We wanted to support him, and we were hoping that we would be able to help him go through this difficult thing that he was going through, get the medical attention he needed while he was in our home. And when we realized that that wasn't possible for this child, it was hard.
Yeah.
It was very hard.
So you finally are connected then with Batman, who is now your son. And it sounds like, though, he was not really excited about this to begin with. He was really resistant about coming to your house and learning about you and becoming a part of your family. Was that also a big disappointment right off the bat when you had just been through this other experience?
It was a challenge, and it was interesting. I have to say, I don't blame him, though. I think my husband and I sort of looked at each other after our first meeting with little Batman, where he basically went to the opposite corner of the room, curled up in a ball, and just would only say, no, I don't want to play. I don't want a snack. I don't want to get to know you. We sort of looked at each other and said, well, I guess I would feel the same way. You know, we're strangers. How is he to know that we have his best interest at heart? And he was living in the Child Crisis Arizona shelter at the time and made it very clear to us that he liked the shelter. They took care of him. He showed us where he ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner and how safe it was, and said, nope. He took one look at our house and said, nope, I don't want to go in there. I don't need a mom and dad. Thank you very much. I live here at the shelter now. Please and thank you.
So how did you finally gain his trust?
It was a slow process, but we worked with the shelter staff to develop a plan to move very slowly. We realized after that initial meeting that this was a kid that needed to move slowly to gain trust. And so we started out by just coming by and visiting him at the shelter, not leaving the site. We played basketball at the shelter. We brought him pizza for dinner and ate pizza in one of the visitor rooms at the shelter. And then eventually one of the staff members at Child Crisis who worked with our son told us, you know, he really likes Batman. He loves Batman. And so we bought him a Batman action figure to come with us the first time we were going to bring him off site. We decided we were going to make the big leap and go to McDonald's for dinner, which is not at the shelter. And that was a big step for him. And so Batman came with us and ordered food for everyone. And so from then on, we started calling him Batman. But eventually, he was lured into the house with pizza.
With pizza.
That did it. And he and Batman decided that it wasn't so bad. He would come back for another visit.
So Batman won his heart and pizza. Okay.
Yes.
But I understand it also wasn't super easy from there on out. Like, how did you handle, he has a family, right? How did you handle that?
So I think for any child coming into foster care, there are at least two major traumatic incidents: the incident that led to them being taken into care, and being taken into care, being ripped from everything and everyone you've ever known in your entire life and going into a completely new world. And that was certainly the case for our foster son. he had experienced a lot and he was grieving. And I think as foster parents, we have this amazing opportunity to help a child grieve and to walk with a child during the worst part of their life. And even if we know that it's going to get better and that we are going to take care of him, he doesn't know that. Mm-hmm. And so I think for us, one of the biggest challenges was showing him that we were going to take care of him and that we understood this grief that he was going through. We heard him, we saw him, and that we were going to be there with him through it, no matter what happened.
So this might be a difficult question, but I think that a lot of people would react to the idea of foster parenting and say, that's a great idea. I would love mm-hmm. to do that. But it's scary and it could be really hard and you're never going to be, you know, their quote unquote real family. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true?
That is a tough question because I think for our foster son, you know, we met him when he was 7 years old. He entered the system at 6. And he's just about 9 now. So he lived a life before he met us. And I've always thought it was important to respect his history mm-hmm. and respect his biological family and respect the fact that he did have that life before he met us. But we have this amazing opportunity to create a new, unique family that's unique to our son and that's unique to us. And while it certainly might be a little different than having a biological child at times, I think it can also be really, really great.
Yeah. Leah Phillips, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Mexico, millions of people drive cars that come from the U.S. Many of those cars haven't been properly imported. Now, state and local officials in neighboring Sonora, Mexico, are seizing some of these irregular cars. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Kendall Bluss takes us to the streets to learn more about the ongoing crackdown.
An officer stops an Arizona-plated truck on the highway outside Hermosillo and checks that it's properly registered. Every day, thousands of cars zip through the bustling traffic on the streets of Hermosillo. Among the chaos are an estimated 50,000 so-called carros chocolates, or chocolate cars. It's a play on words from chueco, or crooked cars, says Hermosillo Public Safety Commissioner Luis Alberto Campalastra. It's one of many names for foreign cars being driven illegally in Mexico. They've become a big problem in Sonora. For years, authorities more or less tolerated these illegally imported vehicles. It's cheaper to buy a car north of the border, and for many families, the cars are one of their only assets and their main form of transportation. But things have gotten out of hand, he says. Amid the traffic, unregistered Hummers and BMWs zoom around town with impunity.
Son cuestiones económicas y también son cuestiones ecológicas.
Without proper importation taxes, registration, and emissions controls, he says, illegally imported cars are bad for the economy, the environment, and most importantly, public safety.
Pero nuestro objetivo es la seguridad.
Chocolate car drivers involved in serious crimes or even minor traffic accidents often just ditch their car at the scene, he says, because they know it can't be traced back to them. So Campalastra decided to start cracking down in early June. Back on the highway, the Arizona couple's documents check out and the officer sends them on their way. Authorities aren't on a witch hunt for foreign cars in Sonora, says Omar Gonzalez. He's executive coordinator of the Foreign Trade Verification Office.
Y pusimos ciertas reglas para este proceso.
They're focusing on cars made in 2010 or newer, luxury vehicles, and cars involved in some type of crime or stolen from Arizona.
We enjoy a very good working relationship with Mexican authorities.
Arizona Department of Public Safety spokesman Bart Graves says so far this year, the number of stolen vehicles returned to Arizona from Sonora has increased.
So the fact that Sonoran authorities are putting more heat on this trade down there helps us tremendously.
But stolen cars make up just a small part of the total estimated 300,000 carros chocolates in Sonora, González says, and the number keeps going up. He says Mexico's president has promised to legalize at least some irregular cars, so people are trying to sneak them into Mexico now. He wants to stop more cars from entering the country, but supports legalizing the ones that are already here.
No, claro, es bueno para todos. O sea,
it's good for everyone, he says, but in the meantime, he has to apply the law. But some Sonorans oppose the decision to start enforcing a formerly lax law.
Esos carros llegaron aquí, llegaron por la corrupción del mismo gobierno.
At her office on the outskirts of Hermosillo, Margarita Sao says government corruption allowed improper importations to flourish. Like González, she's waiting for President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, to legalize these cars. Sao's president of one of many civil associations that register improperly imported cars in Sonora. They can't provide official legal status or protection, but there's an understanding that cars that join these organizations won't be the target of enforcement efforts. It's a gentleman's agreement, says Gamaliel Cañedo. He leads another nonprofit protecting people with carros chocolates. He says as long as there are economic factors pushing Sonorans to buy cheaper cars north of the border, they'll help protect them.
Siempre siguen entrando vehículos.
For now, he says, carros chocolates aren't going anywhere. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Mark Brody and Steve Goldstein. Still to come this hour on the show, we'll check in at a rally for the Affordable Care Act as courts take up another challenge to the law. And stay tuned for The Takeaway at 10 o'clock.
It was 10 years ago this week when one of Arizona's legacy companies, Bash's Supermarkets, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The chain, which includes Bash's, AJ's, and Food City, said the Great Recession, intense industry competition, and a union battle had put it in that condition. Ultimately, the company moved to shutter 10 Bash's and Food City locations and emerged from bankruptcy late in 2010. As of earlier this year, Bash's and its stores claimed nearly 7% of the market, trailing Fry's, Walmart, Safeway, and Costco. So how did Bash's survive, and what is the condition of the company in 2019? With me to talk about that is Trey Bash's, president and CEO. Trey, let's go back a decade. Bash's had been an extremely important local Arizona company. What happened to create the need of filing for bankruptcy protection?
As you know, we were in a major recession. Arizona caught a cold, and Bash's went on life support. That's the way that we look at it. You know, we had made some mistakes as a company. We had overexpanded. We had done some things that stretched us a little bit. All of those we had, at the time, thought that we were proceeding appropriately. No one could have looked into a crystal ball and just saw what would happen at the second half of 2008. So we worked very diligently to try and negotiate with our lenders. We were never in a monetary default. It was a technical default, a covenant default. And when we couldn't do that, we were left with no choice but to file for Chapter 11 protection.
Did you feel like we're going to get out of this pretty soon? Were you a little bit nervous?
I was nervous. We were nervous as a company, mm-hmm. because you're putting all of your future in the hands of a judge. So a single judge, and you have to go and prove to the court that your plan, and you have to create a plan, is acceptable and that you can execute it as a company. So there's a great deal of challenge there. And our judge, Judge Marler, was an amazing man, but he was also very tough. I mean, we literally had to prove ourselves. There was no, this is just a given because you've been part of Arizona's history for however many years.
Yeah. How long did it take for you to feel like things were back in the right direction?
It really didn't feel that way. We were moving the company in the right direction, but until the judge ruled on our plan of reorganization, we really didn't know, because our lenders opposed the plan of reorganization. So the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors co-sponsored our plan. So they co-sponsored our plan. We knew our plan could work. We knew we could execute it. Mm-hmm. The lenders didn't feel that we could execute our plan. And so the judge had to take all of that, had to hold a hearing in order to take all of the evidence, listen to the experts, and then make a ruling. And thankfully, he ruled in our favor.
So we look 10 years ahead now. So what are some changes that you implemented once we got past the recession, once you got past the bankruptcy? Were there changes that had to be made just because this is a competitive industry?
So, of course, there were changes that had to be made. We had failed. We had had to enter into Chapter 11. I think that as a company, we kept stores open long after their useful life. So we didn't look at the individual store on a four-wall basis and really drill down to determine if it was profitable and if it was worth keeping. So we've changed that aspect of how we look at our stores. As far as who we are, no, our foundation is the same. We have been and continue to be a part of the community. We're involved in the community as much as we can be. We're loyal to our members. We call our employees members. You know, they still come first. They did during the Chapter 11. They do today. So the basic foundation is still the same, but I think we approach things a little more critically from a monetary standpoint, from an expansion standpoint, and just looking at the business holistically.
How important is it that Bash has maintained that deep connection to Arizona, even recently opening up another store, Diné store, I think, on the Navajo Nation, right?
Thank you. We did. We opened a new store on the Navajo Nation in Sanders. We now have 8 stores on the Navajo Nation. And that was really an important part of my dad, Eddie's legacy, was to be able to serve our Native American customers because they were some of our first customers. As far as us being part of the community, it's part of our DNA. It's how we were raised. It's who we are and what we're about. So those values were imbued upon us by my great-grandmother, who taught us that you have to give back. You have to be a part, because then as you grow, the community grows as well. So we can't grow in spite of the community. We have to grow together.
Are there things you have to offer to be competitive to some extent? Or are there things that you say, well, let me leave that for the bigger national stores, knowing that we can do something they can't do?
So one of the things that we try and focus on is our perimeter departments. So our meat department, our produce department, our bakery and deli, and try and source and bring the highest quality, freshest available products, to the market. To give you an example, for the first time in our company's history that I can recall, we're bringing in peaches from Georgia. Now, that may be somewhat of a novelty, but, you know, we think that it's something special and different and unique. So we focus there because we don't have the buying power that the competition has for those center store items. That's the reality of the marketplace.
We know how the economy is cyclical. Well, all of us hope we never see a recession like we saw a decade ago, but it's inevitable there will be some sort of pullback at some point. Do you think the company's in better shape now to handle a regular run-of-the-mill recession?
Without question, we are in better financial shape. We are smarter than we were in 2008, 2006, leading up to 2008. So we've proceeded much more cautiously than we have in the past. We've paid everyone off. We've reduced our debt. We've taken care of some legacy items that needed to be funded. So as a company, as a family, we have done all of the right things, we believe. Now, who can say what happens in the future? But we're in a good position to weather a storm similar to what we faced. Now, we think that all of our competition, if it's something that affects all of us greatly, you know, our competition has stores throughout the United States. They're all national, so they have a little bit better staying power if something were just regional to Arizona. But we ourselves, financially, we're healthy. Financially, we're looking at doing the proper things, and we haven't overextended ourselves the way we did prior to the last recession.
That is Trey Basha, the man behind the Basha supermarket chain, locally owned here in Arizona. Trey, thanks.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
The battle over the Affordable Care Act is not over yet. A federal appeals court has taken up a Texas case challenging the ACA, one in which a lower court already ruled the law unconstitutional. Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich joined that case in 2018, and this morning, Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez is in Phoenix to rally for the ACA, and KJZZ's Casey Kuhn is there now with a quick preview. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning.
So give us a quick scene setter. Who's on the roster? Who are you expecting to hear from at this rally?
Right. So we're at the Ability 360 Conference Center over on Washington at in Phoenix. And we're about to hear from, like you said, the chair, Tom Perez, Representative Kelly Butler, Representative Jennifer Longden, and a few other Affordable Care Act proponents all here to talk about what the ACA means for Arizona.
Right. And what is their message? I mean, this would mean a massive overhaul of the healthcare system as we know it. What are they saying this would do?
Right. So it's kind of a big if right now. If this if the court upholds this ruling, it still needs to go to the Supreme Court. The message today is how many Arizonans would be affected if the ACA were to go away, just to drum up support of this act and support of how many people here do benefit from the ACA.
Yeah. So Democrats, I know, really campaigned on health care in 2018, and that did pretty well for them in terms of the results of that election. Is this sort of a blessing from their point of view? Or are they seeing this as an opportunity to campaign on health care once again?
Yeah, it definitely feels like a campaign. You know, there's signs, and it's clearly aimed to drum up support through the press. And according to them, more than 2 million Arizonans, if the ACA were to go away, more than 2 million Arizonans with pre-existing conditions would lose protections. Almost 300,000 would lose coverage. So they're talking about this now because, you know, we're kind of on the lead up to 2020, and people are saying that this has been successful for Democrats in the past. So it could be a good lead up to campaigning in 2020.
All right. That's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn checking in with us from a pro-ACA rally happening in Phoenix right now. Casey, thanks for the info.
My pleasure.
Okay, so Mark, I know you're something of a history buff, right?
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So you clearly know who the Rough Riders are.
Yeah, you know, I often think about watching the History Channel. Don't always get to it. The Rough Riders, though, famous for that charge up San Juan Hill against the Spanish, right?
That's right. So you are a history buff. Okay, but did you know some of those Rough Riders were from Arizona and before it was a state? And they played a pretty big role in getting Arizona statehood.
I must have missed that documentary on the History Channel.
I didn't see one either, but it is interesting, and that is why ASU Now reporter Scott Seckel dug deep into the history of the Rough Riders. And he begins by taking us to the steps of what is now ASU's Old Main, where President Theodore Roosevelt came to give a speech.
Roosevelt was in town to dedicate the Roosevelt Dam, which wasn't officially the Roosevelt Dam until much, much later. I think it started out as Salt River Valley Dam number 2 or something. But anyway, he was in town to dedicate it, and he had done that 2 days before. And he stopped by the Tempe Normal School, which is the precursor to ASU. And it was a college that had been established to teach teachers. So Roosevelt was there to give a speech, and he wasn't supposed to even get out of the car because they were afraid it was going to take too long, too much glad-handing. But he jumped out of the car and gave this impromptu speech for 13 minutes. And you can stand where he gave the speech today on the second landing going up the steps of Old Main. And he talked about how Arizona is really ready to become a state. He used the phrase, a community that has ceased being a frontier community. And he met with things like the dam and the university, that it was ready to earn its star on the flag.
So this is 1911, so Arizona's a territory at this point.
Yes.
So this call for statehood, was this a surprise at the time? Was this a really big deal?
Yeah, people had been bucking for statehood for a long time. It was the motto of the state Republican Party, statehood now. Bucky O'Neill, a famous Rough Rider from Prescott, famous quote from him, he said, "I'd do anything for a star." So the whole state was really gunning for it.
Yeah. So in this speech, and as he's calling for statehood and saying, you know, the state is ready, he mentions these seven men who came from the Tempe Normal School and became Rough Riders, right?
Yes.
So first I want to start with the basic history question here, which is, who were the Rough Riders?
They were an all-volunteer cavalry regiment that was raised in a split second to go help drive the Spanish out of Cuba. It was America's first foreign intervention overseas, militarily.
And why did they come from Arizona?
Well, the Spanish at the time had a standing army of about 200,000, not of all of whom were in Cuba. We had a standing army of about 20,000. So the thinking was, we need men tomorrow. And Roosevelt said, I know exactly the people we want. We want the cowboys from out west. They're used to living outside. They know how to ride. They know how to shoot. They eat lousy food. They'd be perfect. We'd have instant army.
Sure.
And he had had a ranch in the Dakotas in the 1880s. And he was like a little boy when it came to the West. I mean, he would just get around these lawmen who'd been in gunfights, and he was like a little kid and just awed by them. So he wanted a cowboy regiment.
Is that what he ended up getting?
He got a regiment which was a pretty good cross slice of American society. He had not just cowboys, but he had gamblers, teachers, and then he had people, men of his class from back east, Harvard boxers, polo players, men who are used to shooting at ducks and riding steeplechase, not necessarily chasing cows. So there had been some criticism that the Rough Riders are more hat than cattle, but it was a pretty even sprinkling. There were quite a few honest-to-God cowboys.
Cowboys in there.
Yeah.
And how did they get the name the Rough Riders?
That was bestowed on them by the press. And it was kind of cultivated in their uniform. They wore khaki pants and a blue shirt with a neckerchief and a slouch hat. So they look kind of rough, but the press called them Woods Walkers at first, after Leonard Wood, who was their commander. They called them Teddy's Terrors for a while, and the Rough Riders eventually stuck.
Okay, so give us a little bit of the lowdown on what they did in Cuba. I mean, how did they make a name for themselves? Why do we all still know the name the Rough Riders today?
They really went over there and turned the tide. They really helped win the war in two fights, one of which they barely won. And the second one's the famous charge up San Juan Hill, which was just crazy. It was a Civil War-style frontal assault, and they basically scared the hell out of the Spanish. Just all these men rushing up the hill at them. And they won against all odds.
And this is from people who are from a territory, not even a state, right? So it makes sense that the legacy like that contributes to statehood. But you also kind of zero in on the stories of these seven men from the Tempe Normal School that the president mentions in that speech. Tell us a little bit about some of them.
Well, the most famous one is James McClintock. We have a dorm in ASU named after him. McClintock Drive in Tempe and McClintock High School are all named after him. He was older. He commanded one of the troops. He was the only one of them to actually go to Cuba. The other six guys never made it. McClintock made it, was badly wounded in the first battle, and sent to Staten Island in New York to recover in a hospital. But he came back. He was called Colonel or Captain most of the rest of his life. Very well respected in Arizona. Roosevelt appointed him Postmaster General. He was the state historian. He served on all kinds of boards. He was on the team that rode out in the Superstitions to find the site of the Salt River Dam.
Wow.
He did all kinds of things. He was very, very active in all aspects of Arizona life.
And you have this great quote from McClintock in the story about him saying years later that they were all in it for the adventure.
They could not have cared less about Spain or Cuba. It's like, this is going to be a lot of fun. Let's go. I want to go.
Why is it important, do you think, that people who, you know the institution today for what it is today and know Arizona today as a state and don't even really, you know, think about a time when it wasn't, that we know this kind of history and the people who contributed to it?
It really wasn't that long ago. 1911 was just not that long ago. 1912, rather, when we got statehood. It's pretty close history. And I just think it's important that people remember it and how we came to be.
All right. Scott Seckel with ASU Now. Thank you so much for coming in.
Lauren, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.